Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Empowerment Network. It's 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment. Just for you, your main man, Marvin Rome, coming to you live again with the NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George. We're talking about this amazing gift to us. Let's get started. All right. It's a great day for empowerment. And more importantly, it's a great day for African-American empowerment and learning about our history and what slavery did to us and some of our greats as we continue our journey into our history. Talking about African-American heroes, talking about African-American experiences, this is a completely African-American show designed for African-Americans specifically. It's a candid conversation on our history and on our greats that we need to know, pass along to our children, discuss these in groups, and be able to know our history is a great one. So let's talk about the NAAEA. The NAAEA is an association of African-Americans that is designed to really specifically look at the needs of the community in the areas of politics, economics, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, culture, and education. And we're talking about the development of programs and services that educate, inspire, motivate, and empower our people to become the best people that we could be. It is up to us, people. It's up to you to begin today to do the work of working on our communities, working on yourselves, developing your children, holding yourselves and your children and your families accountable, but also working to change the way we see ourselves, to love each other a bit more, and to be the best that we can be. We have contributions that we've made, and we will continue to make contributions. But it is right now, the time is now, for diligent change and acknowledging where we're going next, because it is up to us. We're alive now. All of our greats, many of them have passed. And we all know that John Lewis just passed, but we have many greats. We're going to talk about them today. So I welcome in Brother George. Brother George, welcome to the show.
Offering me the opportunity to speak with the people again, and I'm glad to be here.
All right, well, thank you. And I wanted to say this, right? We've had some great community conversations where we really talked about how this thing has come about in terms of our experience here in America. And we're going to dive into this thing some more and talking about what we need to do, looking at our history and making a comparison and then contrast that so that we can look at ourselves and say, hey, this is a good point. Hey, this is a great point. This person was exceptional. What system did they use? What are the things that they did to make us great? And then begin to understand how to practically apply that to our lives today. So let's begin with going back a bit to talking about the Willie Lynch concept or idea or the impact of Willie Lynch, and then we'll get started with the show.
Well, brother, once again, the Willie Lynch impact really was, it has had a tremendous effect on us. And I think that little by little, we're coming out of it. But in the meantime, I would like to stress the importance of keeping that thought on our minds of how we can deactivate our Willie Lynch chip. And I'm going to try to contribute to that today. And that's a slogan by Dr. Ray Higgins, the Willie Lynch chip. But I want to read a little bit from a book that was written by a brother named Mark Sims on Willie Lynch. And he gives his views and opinions on the impact that it's had on the African-American community. This book is about African-Americans, a very complicated people. African-Americans are a conquered and divided people. We are an amalgamate of bloodlines and cultures. Black Africans were brought to the New World as slaves for white men. Our ancestors were stripped of their original names, religion, and culture. Then they endured 300 years of chattel slavery. If that wasn't enough, our great-grandparents and grandparents and parents endured 100 years of segregation, discrimination, injustice, and inequality. Now the descendants of the slaves are free. We are now free to act like fools. We are free to spend our money anywhere, in any way our little hearts desire. More than ever before, we can live almost anywhere we want and go to school anywhere we want. But the freedom to assimilate into the world of European Americans has also caused African Americans so many problems. Visit any city in the United States of America and you will find African Americans residing in the bad part of town. Why is this? Why are there so many African American men unemployed? Why do so many African American men commit so many murders, perpetrate so many street crimes, and abandon their children? There are many good African American men, but where are they? Are they in the suburbs? Are they in church? Or are they living with white women? African Americans have numerous problems and challenges that impede our progress. We have to deal with institutional racism, modern day capitalism, and the constant vilification of low income African Americans by the media. There are other problems, but the worst one we have to deal with is our own self-hatred. You can thank Mr. Lynch for starting the process and today's white and black leaders for continuing the process of divide and conquer.
Wow. So let me ask you this question, brother. He talked about segregation, discrimination, racism. Then he broke it down with our own self-hatred. What are some ways in which we could do right now that you suggest that our people can look at in which they can begin to perform acts to deactivate that Willie Lynch chip?
I think that if the school system will focus on, and a lot of our social and community organizations will focus on flooding our children's and teenagers' minds with the accomplishments of our people, the things that we have done right in the world, and the things that we have contributed to human civilization. Those things are very impressive, and it's no way that a people can continue to think negatively of themselves when you speak of so many positive contributions to the world in religion, in science, in mathematics, in sociology, in psychology. I mean, we contributed into all these different fields, and we have contributed well. And we've also had great inventors. I mean, practically everything that you look around is practical in your household, things that you use on a daily basis. The mass majority of them, at least 95% of those things, were invented by an African-American man or woman.
That's great advice, brother. We have to love ourselves, and we have to be proactive in changing our communities. Flood your kids' minds with something positive, and you have to do the work of doing that. So community groups, schools, organizations, activists, politicians, and even police, we have to be able to get busy on changing the minds. You change the mind, you change the life. Change the heart, you can change the community. It's our job to do the work of doing the changing. All right, brother, let's get into it now. We're talking today about activists and black organizations. So we'll begin with Frederick Douglass.
Now, Frederick Douglass was a leader in the abolitionist movement and an early champion also of women's rights. And I don't think that a lot of that is really dwelled on because he's focused so much on his abolitionist crusade. Now, he was an abolitionist leader, and he was born into slavery. I don't know if everybody knows that he was born into slavery, but he was born into slavery sometime around 1818 in Talbot County, Maryland. He became one of the most famous intellectuals of his time, black or white, advising presidents, lecturing to thousands on a range of causes, including women's rights and Irish home rule. Because at one point in his life, he traveled to Ireland. And when he traveled to Ireland, he traveled to Ireland because he was trying to escape being re-enslaved. And so he went to Europe, or he went to Great Britain. And when he went to Great Britain, he ended up living in Ireland. And the Irish were being treated very much the same as African Americans in this country. So they were trying to fight for their right to rule their own country. And so even though they were a part of the greater British Empire, they still wanted to rule their own country. And so Frederick Douglass would speak in Ireland, and he was very highly regarded there, you know, for the speeches that he gave on freedom and justice and equality for all men and all mankind. Now, Frederick Douglass, in his early life, he was born Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey, and he was born around 1818, like I said, into slavery. And he, as later on in his life, he chose, you know, to celebrate February the 14th as his birthday. That wasn't his, he didn't know if that was his actual birthday, but he chose to celebrate that at his birthday. He learned to read from it was the lady that was his slave owner. His wife taught Frederick Douglass how to read. Now, many of the local slave owners were very disappointed with the fact that they had taught Frederick Douglass to read, because he was going around and teaching some of the other slaves how to read, and he was influencing them. And so that was like a issue for the slave owners that were around his time. Now, after Frederick was able to escape slavery, which his wife, Anna Mary, helped him to escape slavery, she used a lot of her resources to assist him with money, where he boarded a train, and he was dressed up as a black seaman, and he was given black seaman's identification, and he used that identification to find his way all the way into the north until eventually he was into free territory, and he settled in New York. Now, Frederick ended up marrying Anna Marie, and they had 5 children. And he stayed married to her for a period of time. However, it seems as though a lot of activists, once they started getting overly, you know, into their activism, their marriage, their relationship seemed to be hurt by it. And so he ended up divorcing her, and he married another woman who became close to him because of his fight with women's rights, which most of the women's rights was dealing with white females. And so he ended up with a white female as his wife. Now, Frederick, he is noted for a lot of famous quotes, and I really am impressed by Frederick Douglass's quotes, because I mean, he just had a silver spoon tongue, And I just was, I was always impressed. I even quoted some of one of his quotes to one of my son's middle school principals. Now, this is the quote on the relationship between progress and struggle, and I think it was one of his greatest. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprive agitation are men who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without the thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but there must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will.
Wow. With no struggle, there is no progress. And I'm not sure, when you look at the situation that we talked about in our communities, right, we have to begin to make that struggle again. I'm talking about on the ground now, right, with being able to take care of our children, becoming responsible parents and fathers, educating our children well. So on that education piece, because one of the pillars of the NAAE is education, let's talk just for a minute about the importance of reading, because you mentioned in there that he learned to read and they were disappointed that he was taught to read. So talk about the importance of reading for us briefly.
The importance for reading, you know, for us is that we, for some reason, well, I'm not going to say for some reason, but we don't want to read because we think that all we're going to read about is other people or either something that's negative about ourselves, because that's what we've been exposed to. But actually, there are a great deal of positive things that reading can really bring out of you. You know, when I started reading a great deal, it really informed me as to the many things that we had done. Now, one of the things that you may run into is when people are still history, still your accomplishments, what they'll do is they'll keep repeating the same thing. And, you know, that's where that term comes from. If you tell a lie long enough, it'll start sounding like the truth, or it'll make the truth sound ridiculous. However, when you read a lot of books, and you read from different people's perspectives on the same thing, you'll find that you could tell what the truth is because a multitude of people will be agreeing on the same point. But in order for that to happen, you got to read, you know, a lot of different books. And it's okay to start out reading fiction, you know, because once you learn how to read and increase your speed with reading with your eyes, at that point, you know, you'll be able to read more complicated information, which takes a great deal more concentration to read those kinds of things. But you can learn to appreciate that even if you start reading fictional books first.
Thanks for sharing. I got one more question in regards to reading, and that is, what are some of the books that inspired you and really captured your imagination and got you to want to read and learn more?
Well, one of the books that I'm going to talk about today, The Souls of Black Folks, was one of those books that I thought was a very interesting book by W.B. Du Bois, and I'm going to be talking about him later on today. I haven't completely read the whole book, but I have read excerpts out of it, and that's the opinions and philosophies of Marcus Garvey. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad's book, Message to the Black Man, I believe that every black man should read that book. It's a philosophical book, but you'll definitely be able to relate to it. Black Man of the Now by Dr. Ben is a an interesting book. I also read The Iceman's Inheritance. And The Iceman's Inheritance kind of tells you about the development of the European man, you know, within the Ice Age and the struggles that they went through that, you know, made their nature more capitalistic than anybody else. It's an interesting book, you know, but those are a few of the books that also they came before Columbus, which was a classic writing by Dr. Ivan van Sertima. And he's done a great deal of other books. He's done the history of the Moors in Spain, the golden age of the Moors in Spain. And then you have the history of the Moors in Spain by Stanley Lane Poole, which is another classic. So, I mean, it's a lot of books out here that, you know, you need to read.
Great, brother. Thank you for sharing. So I encourage our listeners to pick up a book and put some time into your self-development. Many of these books, and go back and read or research for yourself. Pull one out and see what you can find out about our history. Let's go into Richmond's famous son, John Mitchell Jr.
Well, John Mitchell, we had John Mitchell Day, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, and we had a whole radio show on John Mitchell for John Mitchell Day. But I'm going to speak briefly about him today because he falls in this category of activists during that time period. John Mitchell was a prominent newspaper editor, educator, politician, banker, and civil rights activist. He was born, you know, in 1863, and he was enslaved at the time. And even though the Emancipation Proclamation had already been established, like I spoke about in earlier programs, all of the slaves were not freed at the same time. And so different states that were still fighting against the Union armies, even though the major surrender had already been made, they were still fighting. So apparently John Mitchell was not freed at that time. But John Mitchell, he was raised in a pretty well-off household. He was raised in the household of a lawyer named James Lyons. And Mr. Lyons, he ultimately became Mr. Lyons' carriage boy. They called him a carriage boy, but basically he was his chauffeur. So by being his chauffeur, he was exposed to a lot of the political activities that Mr. Lyons was participating in because he was his chauffeur. And so he was around a lot of these activities, and I think he learned a great deal of things from being around him. Now, I don't want to try to go over every single morsel of John Mitchell, but John Mitchell's biggest thing was that he was a anti-lynching, you know, fanatic. His thing was anti-lynching. He went out, you know, all out, you know, against white men lynching black men and women. And he even used the term at one time. He said, the best remedy for lynching is to get you a gun. In so many words, that's what he said. He said, get you a gun and be willing to use it to protect your life from these lynchers. You know, so he was very serious about that. And he also saved a young man's life through protests as far as his political activism. He saved a young man's life, and the young man's name was Simon Walker. And Simon Walker was charged with rape with this white woman. And so they wanted to hang him, but he was only 15 years old. And so John Mitchell was saying, like, he's not really getting due process, and y'all want to just rush to judgment and hang this young man. And so John Mitchell went through a lot of undue stress trying to get him a lawyer. and getting stays of execution so he wouldn't be hung. And eventually he got things to the point where he got his sentence commuted, and they took away the hang by the neck until dead and gave him 20 years in prison. And so John Mitchell, he was a great activist. He was a great leader of his time, one of the greatest. And it's not a lot that I knew about him until I started researching, but he was very impactful during that time period.
Right here in Richmond, Virginia, our own John Mitchell Jr., go out and become an activist in your community. It's the only way we're going to change things is that you become your own John Mitchell Jr. and fight for what's right. So coming up in August, we're going to talk about the history of black women. So you want to get in on that. Also, we're going to go back and we're going to encourage you to go back and listen to that John Mitchell Jr. Day celebration show. And also coming up in August, we're going to do an NAAE summit on leadership, right? You got to be able to understand the importance of leadership, and we're going to encourage our people to do that. Brother George, we're coming up on A. Philip Randolph. What do you have?
Well, I just wanted to take a second to speak on the history of black women, because I am going to do that. And I don't want, you know, black women to feel like that I think the only ones that were important in our struggle was black men, because that's far from the truth. And I want to give full credence to black women by, you know, dedicating a series by itself on the accomplishments and history of our black women's accomplishments in many different fields. And so I am going to do that, and that is going to be the next series that I start. Now, A. Philip Randolph is another one that that spans into different eras. You know, he's in the Harlem Renaissance era, and he's also in the Civil Rights era, and he was very impactful in both of them. And I call this the Harlem Renaissance era because the Harlem Renaissance was like, it was more than just arts and music. It was a political movement also. And so all of these things fit into it. And the next portion that I'm going to talk about is the economic portion, which I think that y'all thought I forgot about, you know, the Great Depression and all that, but I haven't. It's just so much that you can't put all of it into one conversation and do justice to it. Now, who was A. Philip Randolph? A. Philip Randolph was a labor leader and social activist. During World War I, Randolph tried to unionize African-American shipyard workers and elevator operators and co-launched a magazine designed to encourage demand for higher wages. He later founded the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which by 1937 would become the first official African-American labor union. Now, that was really important, you know, for him to establish a labor union, because white labor unions was hard enough to establish in a capitalistic society. And he went out and established a black labor union, you know, in the 1940s. Randolph's ability as an organizer had grown to such lengths that he became the driving force in ending racial discrimination in government defense and discriminatory practices in the armed forces, both due via presidential decree. Now, what he's talking about there is that he was able to, like, the defense general supplies and different things like that were like the factories and the places that were doing the paperwork and building tanks and different things like that in the country. And they were discriminating with their hiring with black people. So he protested that to the government, because he's saying, these are not just regular factories. These are factories that's connected directly to you. And so you could do something about it. It's not like this is private enterprise. They're not private, you know. And then eventually, after he got that part done, he eventually was able to get black men and women active in the U.S. militaries. And so that's essentially what they were talking about. Now, A. Philip Randolph was born Asa Philip Randolph on April 15th, 1889, to a Methodist minister who was his father, James Randolph, and his mother, Elizabeth. And they were both staunch supporters of equal rights of African Americans and general human rights. So he was born into a family where they were very focused on people getting rights and people being treated properly. He married an intellectual that he met, a sister at Howard University when he went there, and she was a beauty shop entrepreneur named Lucille Green. Now, that's another thing that I noticed, that our people were in the same field. A lot of our people that were making a great deal of progress were in the beauty products or beauty salon business, and she was one of them. I'm not saying that it was a bad business. I'm just saying that she was one of those. And A. Philip Randolph, like I said, he expanded into the civil rights era. And so I'm going to talk more about him because he was one of the people that were with Dr. King. And so I'm going to talk more about him as we get further into, like, the civil rights era in the 1950s and 60s.
A. Philip Randolph, become active in your community today by discovering what it is that you need to do and then doing it. You have to become effective at change by being a change agent. So here's another example of getting out there and becoming active in the community. You're listening to Community Conversations with Brother George, and today we're discussing activists and black organizations. Next, we have Paul Robeson.
Oh, man. Paul Robeson, man, this is like an amazing brother, man. Like, Paul Robeson was a stellar athlete. He was in the performing arts. He starred in both stage and film. And he also was a singer. He was also a racial activist. And he was a world activist. And so at one point in his career, he became blackballed. But some of the things that Paul Robeson did, like, he was a professional football player. I mean, and only people that know about his history know that this brother was like a super athlete, man. He was like, I could tell you a story about when he first hit the field, right? And this was during his college days. He got on the field, and back then, you know, they didn't have face masks and stuff like that. They just had that leather football helmet on and pads and all of that. And so the white cats, you know, they figured they was going to teach Paul Robeson a lesson, right? And so they jumped on him. They broke his nose. They, you know, I mean, he was all bloody and laid out on the field. And so when he recovered, then he came back. When Paul Robeson came back, that next time that he got on that field, them white cats was catching elbows and punches and every goddamn thing. And Paul Robeson just ran over top of them. And from that point forward, he was well respected. And he's in the College Hall of Fame for football. So, I mean, it's not like that was just like a light part of his lifestyle. However, that wasn't all that he was. You know, I mean, he also played, to me, his most famous role was Othello. And a lot of people don't even know who Othello was. Well, Othello was a Moor. And he was a lieutenant in the Moorish army. And so Shakespeare used to write about the Moors. In a lot of his writings, he's actually, when he's talking about black people, he's talking about Moors. And so he played Othello the Moor in the stage play. And I thought that was very interesting. Now, one of the things that happened to him when he started traveling into Europe and around the world, his views, his political views went with him. And so there was a senator named Joseph McCarthy. And what he would do is he would promote what people ended up calling McCarthyism. And McCarthyism was like the same thing that you see today, where Donald Trump would just accuse somebody of something and not have no proof or nothing. That's the same thing that Joseph McCarthy was doing. He was accusing different people of being communists, and he would have them unjustly investigated and followed around and all that kind of stuff. And so he did that to Paul Robeson, and it essentially, you know, kind of destroyed his career for a period of time. You know, but even through all of that, Paul Robeson's abilities, I mean, you just need to go on YouTube and just listen to some of the debates that he got into during his time, because they're still on, you know, on YouTube. You know, but Paul Robeson was an outstanding athlete, entertainer, professional, activist, all of those things rolled into one was Paul Robeson. And then that robust voice that he had singing, he was just an amazing brother.
Paul Robeson, a true Renaissance man and our brother. You have an opportunity right now to raise your son, to encourage your father or your brother to become his true self by getting involved, by developing himself, his mindset, his state of mind. So for the ladies that's listening, again, we're coming up on the history of black women next week. You don't want to miss that. Encourage your men and your sons to become the best men that they can be. We got something for you coming up, ladies. You won't want to miss it. Brother George, let's slide on over to our great Booker T. Washington.
Now, I know that just about every person that went to school has heard something about Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington was born into slavery. Booker T. Washington put himself through school and became a teacher after the Civil War. In 1881, he founded Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute in Alabama. Now, Tuskegee today is known as Tuskegee University, which grew immensely and focused on training African Americans in agricultural pursuits. A political advisor and writer, Washington clashed with intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois over the best avenues for racial uplift. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois simultaneously, because their paths crossed so much that I'm going to talk about both of them at the same time. Now, I'm going to give a brief background on both of them, and then I'm going to talk about, you know, what drew them into the same spaces. Booker T. Washington, he taught that economic success for African Americans would take time, and that that subordination to white people was a necessary evil until African Americans could prove they were worthy of independent and cultural advancement. They would eventually win acceptance and respect from the white community. Now, that was called the Atlanta Compromise. When he did that, he did that at a speech, and it's like, you know, I don't agree with that. Okay, but when you try to put yourself, I try to put myself in the mind of what they were facing during that time, and he was in the South. And so what he was trying to do was he was trying to get us the necessary resources to advance. I'm trying to think out of his mind. I think he was trying to get us the necessary resources and not be a threat to white society so that we could kind of be seen and not heard, but making progress at the same time. And I think that's what he was trying to do. Now, I'm going to move to W.B. Du Bois, because like I said, I'm going to talk about the both of them at the same time. Now, Du Bois got born into slavery. Du Bois was, he was born William Edward Burkhart Du Bois. Okay, now that's what the W.B. Du Bois stands for, the W.B. Was born on February 23rd, 1868, in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. While growing up in a mostly white American town, Du Bois identified himself as mulatto, but freely attended school with white people and was enthusiastically supported in his academic studies by his white teachers. Now, that tells you a lot. Now, this is the interesting part. In 1885, he moved to Nashville, Tennessee to attend Fisk University. This was where his first encounter came with Jim Crow, because up until that point, he was basically living, you know, the life of, you know, a free man. You know, he never was a slave or anything like that, and his parents were pretty well off. As a matter of fact, by him being a mulatto, his father was Caucasian and his mother was black. So he didn't have the same life's experience as Booker T. So I'm trying to compare and contrast as I go along. Now, one of the accomplishments, one of W.B. Du Bois's greatest accomplishments was the Niagara Movement. Now, the Niagara Movement was a civil rights group founded in 1905 near the Niagara Falls. Scholar and activist W.B. Du Bois gathered with supporters on the Canadian side of the Niagara Falls to form an organization dedicated to social and political change for African Americans. Its list of demands include an end to segregation and discrimination in unions, the courts, and public accommodations, educational opportunity. Although the Niagara Movement had little impact on legislative action, its ideals led to the foundation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is today's NAACP, in 1909. So his establishment of the Niagara Movement, eventually he wasn't able to get all of that radical stuff that they wanted to get done through the Niagara Movement. But what they did was they mixed in some white leadership with W.B. Du Bois, and they formed the NAACP. Now, between Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington, on the one hand, was saying, like, we need to get trades and agriculture, in other words, learn how to farm or learn how to be an auto mechanic or learn how to be work on a piping, you know, be a plumber. He was saying that it would be better if we would get a trade, because trades, we could barter with each other with trades. And so we could help each other and we could make progress at the same time. And so he felt as though, plus he was talking about farming and agriculture and different things like that. So all of it was knitted into what his thoughts were. Now, W.B. Du Bois was an educated black man. He still identified with being a black man. Even though he was a mulatto, he still identified with being what they call colored back then. And so his thing was, no, we don't have to wait to be respected by other people in this country. We should be respected right now. And also, we should also be able to compete to be accountants and lawyers and businessmen in different professions, you know, to that extent. And we should be able to also be able to go to the best colleges in the land. And we shouldn't have to just settle for anything. And so that was his viewpoint. And he was very, very upset when Booker T. Washington gave that speech in Atlanta, which they called the Atlanta Compromise. And from that point forward, they just clashed heads from then on. Now, to me, I think that both of them were right in one way or another, because everybody's not going to be a professional and everybody's not going to be a tradesman. But we need some tradesmen and we need some professionals. It seems like that it was a little bit of that Willie Lynch thing right there also, because why those two could not come together. And later on, you also find that he clashed with Marcus Garvey, Booker T, W.B. Du Bois. He clashed with Marcus Garvey also. But I just wanted to, you know, kind of give you a compare and contrast between W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington.
Man, brother, I'm glad you added the Willie Lynch piece in, because we have two greats. Simultaneously, one is reaching our people in the North and one is reaching in the South. And so instead of dividing and pushing our points, we can say, hey, you work that in and I work that in, and then we can come together to create something where we can reach all of our people. And so we have to understand how we must stop dividing amongst ourselves and this thing about, well, I ain't fooling him no more and I ain't talking to her no more. We got to stop that and learn how to continue to come together to work to accomplish a common goal, and that is to help our people to become better than we were. Hey, brother, let's move on to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Okay, now we're getting into, we talked about one institution, which was basically an integrationist institution. Now, we're going to get to the more nationalists and radical, what they call radical institutions. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad was born about October 7th, because once again, all of them are saying that they don't exactly know when they were born, the exact day. Sometimes they know the year, but it might be one year or it might be another year. But they weren't really keeping good birth records and all of that stuff on black people. He was the son of, he had 12 other brothers and sisters at the time that he was being raised. And he eventually, you know, he grew up on a farm. And he had to end up farming the land just like the rest of his brothers and sisters. And eventually he and his wife ended up leaving Georgia, where he was born, and decided to go up north. So he ended up in Detroit. And on July the 4th, 1930, The person that is called the long-awaited savior for the black man and woman, Master W. Farrar Muhammad, appeared in the city of Detroit. He announced and preached that God is one, and it is now time for blacks to return to their original ancestral religion, which is Islam. News spread all over the city of Detroit and the preachings of the great man from the East. Elijah Poole, at the time, was what his name was. His wife first learned of the Temple of Islam and wanted to attend to see what was going on. But Elijah Poole told his wife that, no, I'm going to go down there myself. You know, I'll tell you what's going on, but I'll go down there. So he went down there, and he was very impressed by what Master Farad Muhammad said. And so he immediately joined. And so once he joined, he became very energetic, and he was doing a lot of different things. And Master Farad Muhammad said, okay, well, you right now, you my best top follower. So I'm going to give you a new name. And so he named him Kareem. Now, one of the things that people need to understand is that Master W.D. Farad Muhammad was the founder of the Nation of Islam, not the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, not the founder of the Nation of Islam. Okay, later, he gave him the position of Supreme Minister and changed his name to Muhammad, and that's when he became Elijah Muhammad. He still wasn't the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He was Elijah Muhammad. And so he quickly caught on. He was, and Master Farad Muhammad started teaching him the teachings from the East, which is what we call today the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And so he began to teach him and teach him, and in 1934, Master Farad Muhammad, he left. And he left the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in charge of the nation, and like, you don't need me anymore, and you can teach your people, and you could do what's necessary to bring them out of the condition that they're in. And so from there, he began teaching, and the nation continued to grow, and it continued to grow. And he's another one that spans into what is called the Civil Rights Era. But I want to continue with him when we get to the Civil Rights Era, because that's a vital time, because that's when Malcolm X and Minister Farrakhan and some of the other prominent ministers come into the nation in the 1950s. They didn't come in the 1930s. This is when it was being established. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to lay some groundwork for so that you would know who Elijah Muhammad was.
Okay, so real quick, let's talk about the Nation of Islam, right? I want you to talk about the leadership of Malcolm X and Minister Farrakhan, and then talk about some of the principles, right, that I think our people need. I think the nation has a great program for revitalizing our people, right? So talk briefly about that, and then we'll move on to our great Marcus Garvey.
Well, one of the things that I didn't mention was a few of the books that I suggest that you read by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He has so many books, but it's a couple that I think you should read. And number one is one that I mentioned earlier, The Message to the Black Man in America. And number two is The Theology of Time. Now, the Nation of Islam, when you talk about becoming a member of the Nation of Islam, when I was active soldiering, the discipline that's taught is an understanding, you know, like it's a lot of detailed stuff that you're taught, but the real discipline and the real inculcating of it getting into your spirit and your soul, and it grabs you. That is something through repetitiously seeing other brothers maintaining and keeping their word, dressing sharp, standing tall. I remember when I first got in and I heard that slogan, you know, brother, you came up from a Negro in the grave to a fast moving, quick thinking Muslim. And, man, when I seen them brothers walking fast like that, I said, man, that's what they're doing. Those is fast-moving, quick-thinking Muslims. And so it was a sense of pride that you were being given. It was a lot of things like having our own bakeries, and you go to your bakery and you buy one of those bean pies that nobody else was selling that tasted so good. And then the way that the sisters were dressed, where they weren't trying to show everything that they had. You had to leave the mind to suggest
what might be under there, you know. And so it was like they were beautiful and intelligent sisters that could speak equally as well as some of the brother ministers, you know. So it was just a great experience at being a part of the Nation of Islam, and still am.
Great, great. You're listening to Community Conversations with Brother George. Today we're talking about these great, great, great activists and black organizations. So we're down to Marcus Garvey. Let's talk about our great Marcus Garvey.
Okay, Marcus Garvey, Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Marcus Garvey was an orator for the black nationalist and pan-Africanist movements, to which end he founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association and the African Communities League. Garvey advanced a pan-Africanist philosophy which inspired a global mass movement known as Garveyism. Garveyism would eventually inspire others from the Nation of Islam to the Rastafari movement. And I have to agree with that, you know. Well, let me just tell you a little bit about his life. Marcus Garvey was born in 1887, and he was born in Jamaica, St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica. He was self-educated, and, you know, they say that he was self-educated, and I kind of believe that, but they also said that his father had an extremely large library. So if his father had an extremely large library, it seems like when they talk about, you know, when we were enslaved, they talk about the slave owner teaching us how to read, but they didn't say that Marcus Garvey's father taught him how to read, which that's who probably taught him how to read. But at any rate, I do have to agree that when I look at his movement and the things that they did, that his movement was very similar to the Nation of Islam. The only difference between him and Elijah Muhammad was Islam and Christianity, you know. And so Marcus Garvey, he was the father of black nationalism, in my view. And, you know, he can never be replaced. And he was an honorable man with a great deal of influence throughout a lot of our people and a great deal of accomplishments. And they honored him in Africa, in Ghana, because he set up an economic movement in this country, one of which called the Black Seas Shipping Company. And so what they did in Ghana was they named the shipping movement of the Navy called the Black Seas in honor of Marcus Garvey.
And there you have it, folks. Another amazing conversation with Brother George, part 6 of our conversation discussing what slavery did to us. And you can see how we have greats that have come through and that have paved the way for us to be where we are now. It is our job and our mission to move the needle forward. You have such great organizations. Right, you have people who have committed their lives to change. And so I'm challenging you to become highly educated, highly motivated, fast-moving, quick-thinking brothers and sisters that's making a change in this world today. We thank you, Brother George, for joining us today. Join us on Saturday for Empowerment Saturday. A live conversation is going to be good. We'll be talking about creating institutions that define our own reality. You won't want to miss that. We're going to talk about sisters next week with Brother George and the history of black women, or in the future. We're also coming up on a leadership summit as well. Stay tuned, get involved, stay involved, stay connected, and becoming the best that you could be today and every day. It's the NAAEA, improving our community each day, every day, one day at a time. I'm Marvin Rohn. Join us on the web at www.naaea.weebly.com. Become a member. You can't lose with the stuff we use. We'll talk to you soon. Peace.
coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been